again. Hope you are well. As we begin this new year, as we begin this new sermon series in Mark, we're going to be looking through the different texts of Mark, starting right here at this crucial point. We'll talk about that in a second, but right here at this crucial point in Jesus' ministry, all the way as we head towards Jerusalem, getting to Palm Sunday, getting to the triumphal entry. We use this moment because this is a moment. Jesus actually orchestrates this moment right here for a very specific and important reason. It's a fundamental point in Jesus's ministry. We read in Mark that up until now, Jesus has been demonstrating, he's been doing all of these demonstrations of his power and his authority as the Messiah, as the Son of God. The disciples, they've witnessed numerous miracles, exorcisms, healings, teachings, and now having displayed his messianic power, Jesus turns his attention to another theme. And he actually uses this moment in our text as sort of that central, crucial point that makes a shift and we start heading towards Jerusalem. Jesus actually orchestrates this moment in a very specific way with a very specific question. You could almost think of it like a midterm exam in his ministry. You know, if you've ever been to school, right, like halfway through, it's like, okay, we're kind of shifting gears now. But before we do that, let's kind of make sure you have a grasp of everything that we've talked about already in the class before we move on and start looking at the second half. And that's really what this moment is in Jesus' ministry and in Jesus' discipleship of the disciples, is this question. It's only a one question midterm, so pretty easy, you'd think. Okay, just a one question one, but obviously has major implications of what it is. At once this moment happens, Jesus, like I said, begins his journey to Jerusalem and the cross. And so we're headed that way as well. We have 13 weeks until we hit Good Friday and Easter. And so we're going to be joining Jesus on the journey. We're going to be joining him on the journey to Jerusalem. And like I said, we'll arrive on Palm Sunday with the triumphal entry text. So I'm excited to kind of go on this journey with you as we look at the book of Mark. Now, Mark is noteworthy for a specific reason. As you compare Mark with the others, you notice that it's significantly shorter. Mark is our shortest book of the Bible, and that's sort of noteworthy, is that what Mark tends to do, he typically tells the same stories that Matthew and Luke are telling, but he does it in a much more condensed way. His stories are often much shorter. Sometimes he'll tell a whole narration that only is two or three verses, and then he moves right on to the next one. So it's very quick snippets of Jesus' life and his ministry. He snatches little speeches and dialogues and other events and uses very few verses to actually do that. You're going to notice that throughout the sermon series, is that sometimes there's only going to be four or five verses because that's just how Mark rolls. He's not one to pontificate. He's getting right to the point. He wants you to know what is happening. And so one of the things we need to do in Mark in order to really understand what he's doing is actually understand the overarching theme, the overarching melodic line of what he's doing, so that when we get to each and every one of these little short snippets, we understand why he's placing that there or here in order to make the greater point that he's trying to make. This passage today is Jesus introducing this greater point. Up until now, Jesus really hasn't mentioned much about what we're going to look at today. But again, now that this midterm has come, and Jesus is now going to turn his face towards a new attention, he's going to start heading towards the cross, we get in this text the first time Jesus is really going to announce his intentions for the rest of his ministry. And that will then become a theme throughout the rest of this journey that Mark is going to take us on as we head to Jerusalem. So again, there's all these little snippets we're going to find, but there's this overarching theme that Mark is trying to do, and he's using these little snippets all throughout the way in order to help us see that greater narrative. So this moment introduces the theme, and it's this. It's quite simply this. Jesus reorients our whole way of understanding death. Jesus, throughout this journey we are going to go on, he is going to be reorienting his disciples, and therefore we as his disciples will come along with him. He reorients our entire understanding of death. It's a willingness to die so that we can live. It's a willingness to die so that we can live. It's a death and resurrection. Quite simply, it's a pattern that Jesus is going to show us again and again on this journey of what it looked like to die and then to be resurrected. This pattern again and again and again. Let's take a look at our passage, Mark 8, starting in verse 27. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and others one of the prophets." And Jesus asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" There's the question. And Peter answered him, "You are the Christ. You are the Christ." Now we're told that they're heading through the villages. They're in the region of Caesarea Philippi. The Bible doesn't waste words. So when we're given little details like that, that's a note, that's a key to it, particularly in narrations, to let us know that there's something interesting, there's something important for us to note about why they were there. Why did Jesus want to have his midterm exam there? In fact, all the Synoptic Gospels tells us this story and then tells us that they're in Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi is about 25 miles north of the most northern communities, religious communities in Galilee. Most of the time, Jesus is hanging around. He's spending a lot of his time in the Galilee. He's spending his time in that region. Caesarea Philippi is 25 miles north of even that. So it's needless to say, they are way out of their way. There is really no reason for them to be there. So that's our first note. It's like, all right, so Jesus wants to do something. There's a noteworthy thing he wants to do. And if his beginning of his ministry is all leading up to this crucial question, this crucial moment, Jesus is actually orchestrating intentionally a moment by taking them 25 miles north of anywhere they usually go. So they move in that direction. But more than that, this city had a long history of immoral activity in pagan worship. In the Old Testament, King Jeroboam built a high place there, and it became the center of the worship of Baal. The Baal worship centered in this region. Eventually, though, worship of Baal was replaced with the Greek fertility gods like Pan. And in fact, the Greeks renamed the city Panias in his honor. And so the fertility gods of the Greeks, as the Greeks began to move into the area, they just replaced one god for another, but that worship there remained. And then finally, when Rome came into the territory, Herod Philip rebuilt and he renamed the city after himself, Philippi. But it continued to be a focal center for pagan worship. And one of the reasons is because of the geography. There's a special geographic situation happening in Caesarea Philippi that made this a central place to come and worship. You see, there was a cliff. And I want to show you a few pictures here of Caesarea Philippi and what this looks like. But there was a cliff there. And on the cliff, they would inscribe these. This is an actual picture there. They would use the side of this cliff, and they did inscribe all sorts of different idols and gods and shrines into the very face of the mountain there, so that they could come, and there would be these all sorts of these different shrines on the side. And the reason they were located there was right next to it was a cave. Now take a look here at this cave. There's a cave right next to it. You can see sort of the archaeological find of it. So those shrines were there that we just looked like on the right. And then there was this massive cave that was right in the heart of Caesarea Philippi. And what was noteworthy about this cave is that at that time, there was this spring water that would run from the cave. It would come out of the cave and eventually meet up with the Jordan River. You can see it here. There was an earthquake that happened a few hundred years ago, kind of reoriented the water. But at that time, this spring here, you can still sort of see the cave there. This spring ran right out of the mouth of this cave, which was a very interesting and certainly an abnormal place to find a source of water coming out of. Just the way the geographical geography of that area caused this very unique situation in Caesarea Philippi that drew people to the cave. That this water was coming out of the dark cave. Now in a ancient pagan mind, water, they knew water was a necessity for life. And they figured then that, okay, if water is flowing out of this cave, that there's something mysterious about this cave. That must be where the gods live. Because the water, in their mind, that comes out from the underworld. This is where the gods are. And this is why you can understand why for literally thousands of years, this place was seen as a holy place. A place where you'd worship Baal or you'd worship Pan or you'd worship any type of whoever was in that area knew and recognized this is a very sacred place. Water flowing out of a cave. And in their minds, they said, well, then this is where this cave, this is where the gods live, particularly Hades, the underworld gods, where the water would flow out and provide life and then bring death in. And so there was this term that began to be used of this cave. They said, these seem like the gates to the underworld. And so they said, this must be the gates of hell, they called it. And we actually have rabbinic sources that call it and use this very term. There are some rabbinic sources that really do talk about that when the Messiah came, that the gates in Caesarea Philippi would crumble and fall because they understood and they recognized that this was a term given to this cave in this holy site in Caesarea Philippi. It were the gates of hell. Now, it's not in Mark, but if you look at Matthew's account of this exact moment, if you look at Matthew's account of what's going on here, take a look at what Jesus says. After Peter confesses Jesus is Christ, Jesus says to him, and I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Jesus is doing something here. He said, hey, listen, we're gonna take a trip, a road trip, guys. It's time for a road trip. We're going to go 25 miles north, and I am going to quite literally... Not literally, but in as literal as a sense, I'm going to bring you to the very gates of hell itself. And we're going to stand there, and then I'm going to ask you the question. Who do you say I am? Because if you answer correctly, and Peter does, then guys, not even the gates of hell are going to keep us from what God has intended. Not even the gates of hell are going to hold up to what God has in store. Now, if you're Peter, if you're one of the other disciples, aren't you not absolutely jazzed up for this? I mean, wouldn't you just be like, right? Like I can think of like the you know, we're all excited about the Bills game tonight. Everyone's going to get ramped up. Can you imagine you've been following this rabbi and he's been teaching and now he takes you on this long trip, 25 miles north. He brings you right to the very gates of hell himself and he says, guys, get ready. It's time. And not even the gates of hell are going to hold us back. They're not going to stand. And not only that, think about that. Gates in the ancient, in an ancient city were for defense, right? They weren't for offense. You built a gate to keep people out, to hopefully hold people back from entering. So when Jesus says the gates of hell will not prevail against us, that's actually an offensive mindset, right? You are attacking the gates. So who's the attackers? Who's the aggressors in this situation? It's Jesus and the disciples. We're going to crash the gates. This is an offensive attack against them. I mean, the disciples, I can imagine, are just all jazzed up about this. They are ready. They are chomping at the bit. Peter is like, you're the Christ. No doubt. I got my sword by my side. Let's do this thing. We're going. You just name it. Who are we picking off first, Jesus? Let's do this thing. Let's crash this party. Jesus comes onto the scene making all sorts of claims that he is the Messiah that they had been waiting for. And Peter has given up everything to follow this charge. He's got his sword by his side, and he is ready to go. Next verse. And Jesus strictly charged them to tell no one about him. Okay, I mean, we're all jazzed up. Okay, but sure, all right, we won't say anything. Maybe you have a coming out party or something, fine. But then he began to teach him that the Son of Man must what? Must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. And he said this plainly. Talk about a letdown, right? It's like bum bum ba dum. Like, oh, it's pretty good, wasn't it? You knew what I meant. Talk about a letdown. Oh my goodness. He just riled them all up. He brought them 25 miles. He brought them to the very gates of hell itself. And he goes, okay, all right, guys, yeah, we're going to do this. All right, gather around. Here's the plan. We're going to suffer. We're going to get rejected, and I'm going to be killed. Can you imagine? Jesus, the Messiah, the miracle worker, the Son of Man, the conquering hero, begins to explain what he's about to do. And instead of using language of conquering and dominance and power, describes it in terms of suffering and rejection and death. And he doesn't want to be known. And I don't think that's lightly. Think of that. This is the single most life-altering man and message. And he strictly charges them not to let anyone know. There seems to be something about Jesus and his words that actively avoid platforms and public influence and self-aggrandizing. And it is only after Jesus is gone that he commissions them to spread the message to the ends of the earth. But Jesus seems to have no interest in his earthly life to find any pedestal or platform for him to promote himself on. And then the text says that it's said plainly. No confusion, no ambiguity, no concealment, no misunderstanding. Jesus says it, this is as plain as he can say it. So there'd be no misunderstanding whatsoever what Jesus' intentions were. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. You know, we sometimes like blame Peter, like, how, Peter, come on. You just admitted, you just professed Jesus as literally God. And within like two verses, you have the gall to pull him aside and tell him he's wrong. I mean, he's a passionate guy, but even for him, that seems like a little much. But again, when you understand everything that's going down, do you half blame the guy? Peter's entire life and lineage was rooted in the understanding that God had placed his people, the Jewish people, on the earth to be a display of who God was to the world. This world would reject them, they would persecute them, they would enslave them. In fact, ever since the exile of the Promised Land, they had been dominated and controlled by one foreign oppressor after the other: Babylon, Assyria, Persia, and now currently under Roman rule. And so the great hope for the Jew is that one day this Messiah would come, a conquering king, a military leader, who would punish these evildoers, reclaim the glory and freedom of Israel. In Peter's perspective, Jesus, I've given up everything to proclaim you as Christ and follow you. And now you're telling me that your plan to storm the gates of hell include, check the transcripts, suffering, rejection, and death? Maybe Peter isn't too far out here. But Jesus' response is equally direct. Peter does not have, what does Jesus say? You do not have the things of man, but only merely human concerns. It's the human concerns. It's the way of the world. It is the gods and the idols and the worship that it's not interested in the way of God. It's these world systems that live for their own power and glory and empire, hierarchy, who's faster, who's stronger, who has this more social power, who can conquer the other, who has the money, who's smarter, who's better, who's got it all together. It's the pattern of the world. It's the way the world works. And wired into our nature is this belief that strength comes from power and control and conquest. A few years ago, I was actually mediating a disagreement, a very heated, pointed different disagreement between two people who are family members. And as we sat there and as I was listening to them, it was just one bomb after another, just one accusation after another about you did this and no, you did that. And well, I did that because you did that. And there was just this, it was just this match of wills and power and strength and control. Who could top who? They were like two boxers who took turns jabbing at each other in retaliation. And as the conversation went on, I couldn't help but think the only way that this was ever going to be resolved is if one person put down their gloves. It's the only way. Whenever there's an argument, it always, whether it's with your spouse, whether with a friend, whether it's with a family member, whether it's with a coworker, it always takes the first person to put down the gloves. And usually what happens is you take a few punches that way. You get a couple of jabs. And it's only when you've been jabbed enough times and the other person realizes that you are not going to respond anymore, is there progress in moving forward. And that was what was happening here. It was power on power. And I said to them, at some point, one of you is going to have to put down the gloves. But it's so hard to do because everything rooted in our bones tells us that weakness is giving up. Weakness is laying down. Weakness is putting down the gloves. Strength is when I can top you, when I have the better response, when I can tell the joke that hits you in that little way that makes me feel more powerful. That's what we know. That's the world. And Jesus is inviting us to put down the gloves. He says, hey, look, we're going to do that, but the way to do that is with suffering and rejection and death. There is a reason why Peter rebukes Jesus, and it's because the mystery of Christ is hard for us to grasp because our entire world is oriented in the opposite direction. So what Jesus does on this journey to Jerusalem is he reorients our whole way of understanding death. It's a willingness to die so that we can live. Death and resurrection. Death and resurrection. He goes on, Mark 8:34, and calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up the cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life would lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world, forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? Take up your cross. So Jesus doesn't just tell them what he's going to do, but he invites them into this Christ pattern with him. Now, taking up your cross does not mean whatever hardship you're going through, right? When you have a leaky faucet, you don't go, oh, man, this is my cross to bear right here, right? When you're going through a problem at work or in a personal life, that's not necessarily your Christ to bear either, because a cross is not a hardship. The cross is an instrument of death. Jesus isn't calling you to endure hardship. Jesus is calling you to die. Everything that's oriented in one way, he's saying, we're going to have to deprogram this. You're going to have to actually die to these things, the one-upping and the power and trying to get ahead and trying to have control and trying to live in a certain way, trying to choose what you want. You're going to have to put all of that to death. So taking up your cross is not just whatever difficulty transpires in your life at any given time. It's actually the very act of dying, joining Jesus on the journey to Jerusalem towards the cross. Taking up your cross is an instrument of death. I love that in his book, maybe you've thought of this, in his book, Cost of Discipleship, right? Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he writes this book, and let me tell you, it will just rock you, this book. We've actually done it. Our elder Ed, he's actually walked through some of these ideas with us. But it's this idea that when we join Christ, we come to die. He writes this in his book. He says this: the cross is laid on every Christian. Every Christian who claims you are the Christ, their prize is a cross. The cross is laid on every Christian. The first Christ suffering, which every man must experience, is the call to abandon the attachments of this world. It is that dying of the old man which is the result of his encounter with Christ. As we embark upon discipleship, we surrender ourselves to Christ in union with his death. We give over our lives to death. Thus it begins. The cross is not the terrible end to the otherwise good, fearing, and happy life, but it meets us at the beginning of our communion with Christ. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. Come and die. But, as he says, death is not the end of the story. Death doesn't get the final word. Death doesn't win in the end. Because Jesus says, 3 days later, I will rise. And Bonhoeffer says, the cross, though, is not the terrible end, but it's the beginning. The cross is the beginning, but it's not the end. Because there's a resurrection that comes from death. That's the Christ pattern. Death and resurrection. Dying to self so that a new resurrected eternal life might be born. When we die to the way of the world, we enter into this new eternal life of joy and hope and love and freedom and self-forgetfulness. Jesus comes and establishes a new reality, a new rhythm, a new pattern that says death is no longer weakness and surrender and failure, and resurrection is no longer vague or distant or abstract. And if we enter into the Christ pattern, we will experience this new resurrected life, not just in the future, but right now. A life of freedom. Freedom from worry, freedom from trying to get ahead, freedom for fighting for what's yours, a freedom from significance. We die, and then we're resurrected. That's the pattern. And Jesus ends. He says, for whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with his holy angels. Now, the word ashamed here, interesting, is not a noun. It's a verb. Ashamed isn't something you have, or shame isn't something you have. It's an action that you do. So the root of this word, ashamed, means to disfigure or to change. So when you are ashamed of something, you will inevitably change it to something more palpable. You will disfigure it. That's what ashamed means. That's the root of ashamed, is to defigure something. Because when I'm ashamed of something, I will inevitably change it to something that I can taste and is more appealing to me. And so when we do not choose the pattern of Christ, this pattern of death and resurrection, what we end up doing is disfiguring him and his words. Whoever is ashamed of me and my words. And what we do is we change it, we manipulate it, we disfigure it in order to create something a little more palpable, something that will sell a little better, something that will get more people to come to church. Let's just tweak it a little bit. Jesus' message is good, but he needs a little upgrade. That's what being ashamed is. Ashamed is something you do. It's not something you have. You do ashamed. You do shame. Now, what this means is that we will all struggle to die to ourselves. We will all work hard, and we will all fail and be flagellant, because it doesn't come natural to us to die to ourselves, to our flesh, to the old man. It's hard. But that's not what ashamed means. Struggling with it, working hard. That's not it. Changing it is what is. Switching it, disfiguring it, altering it. And think of all the ways that we disfigure Jesus and his words. Gossip. at its core, is a power play. At its core, what gossip is bringing yourself above the one that is not there to defend themselves. It's a power play. It's that fight, conquest, conquering, being the aggressor. It's passive aggressive, but it's aggressive. And it manipulates and it disfigures Jesus in his words. A critical spirit is a posture of superiority, walking around believing, I really know, you know, kind of what's going on, and I can kind of judge as an expert opinion. It's actually a posture of superiority, embracing yourself as the expert judge above the rest. It's a disfigurement of Jesus and his words. Unforgiveness is the belief that you are owed more than you are owed. You are somehow more important, that you've risen to a level of moral superiority that others require, in order to receive forgiveness from you, require a certain level of penance that God does not require of you. It's a disfigurement of Jesus and his words. We could go on and on. And on. Everyone is a decision to choose a destructive attachment, right? A destructive attachment is the conviction that you are smarter and that the conventional wisdom doesn't apply to you. I can get by, I can still engage in this thing, and I'll just kind of keep it over here, and it won't necessarily infringe upon my daily walk or life. It's a disfigurement of Jesus and his words. Focusing on platforms and influence and admiration is the sin of significance. It's convincing yourself that what you have to offer is original and indispensable. It's a disfigurement of Jesus and his words. You pick it. You name it. What is it for you? Where have you put yourself above others in your daily life with dominance and control and power? And it's a lot easier to see when we're talking about Babylon and Assyria and Rome, and it's a lot harder when I'm sitting in the pew and I don't have a sword in my hand. But my words will cut. I don't have a weapon in my hand, but I use my power and my influence to weaponize other things. I weaponize that. You see, we all have it. It's this rhythm. It's this way of the world. On the journey to Jerusalem in Mark, we will see Jesus of Nazareth highlight this death and resurrection pattern over and over again. In fact, Mark will structure this section with Jesus foretelling his death and resurrection three times. Scholars call it the prophecies of the Passion. And in between these three major movements that Mark is going to do to get us to Jerusalem, in between it, we're going to see all sorts of ways in which the disciples don't get it. They will fight over status. They'll attempt to tent build. They'll be warned about the rich. There'll be requests to be given a place of honor. And all the while, Jesus is going to do things like emphasize children and blind men and demon-possessed. And there's this cycle that Mark is going to show us that's just going to keep going. Jesus is going to pronounce this again. The disciples aren't going to get it, and then he's going to have to explain it and show with a tangible visual, like a child or a blind man or a demon-possessed man. And then he's going to do it again, and the disciples will then start arguing over who gets to sit on the right hand of Jesus, right hand of the Father. And Jesus is going to then have to reteach them and point to a new thing. It's a rhythm that Mark's going to institute again and again. It's a pattern. It's a flow of life. Jesus reorients our whole way of understanding death. It's a willingness to die so that we can live. Let's call the band up as we close here this morning. This is my prayer for you all. This is my prayer for us, is that this might be a moment that just as Jesus created his own moment for his disciples, that in this moment, on January 7th, as we start our path and our journey to Jerusalem, that this might be a moment for you as well. You see, we stand at the gates of hell, all the gods beckoning us to come and worship, all the attachments of the world. And we will be asked the question too, who do you say I am? And friends, if your answer is Jesus, if Jesus is the Christ for you, then he commands you to come and die. He says it plainly. No confusion, no ambiguity, no concealment, no misunderstanding. Everything in us is wired to believe that strength comes through power and control and conquest, whether it's social or financial or control or achievement. We are tempted to be ashamed and to disfigure Jesus and his words. But whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake in the gospel will save it. You see, friends, the Christ pattern works in the world in a very specific way. You die, and then you're resurrected. That's the heart of it. Death and resurrection. We let go of the old in death so we can receive and embrace the new in life. The death and resurrection of Jesus isn't just some nice abstract idea that gets you somewhere when you die. It's how the world works. And when you trust Jesus with his words, and when you actually enter into it, you will have life and life to the full. So my prayer is that we as a community will go on a journey in the next 13 weeks. That we will embrace this death in a real, tangible, concrete way. Let me ask you some questions. When we talk about gossip, where have you elevated yourself in your speech? Where in this community, if we're going to go on a journey together, we need to start asking some hard questions. Where have we elevated ourselves in our speech? Where does that need to die? Or if critical spirit, where do you need to reserve judgment? When was the last time you saw or disagreed with something or someone's handling of a situation and the response was, man, I'm not sure if I do it that way, but I am sure there are aspects and elements of that decision that I do not know, and so likely they have all sorts of factors I'm unaware of, and so, you know, I'm going to respect their decision because I don't necessarily know all the things that went into that, and so I'm going to trust them because I love them. Versus, what an idiot. I can't believe he made that decision. I can't believe they did that way. I can't believe that they made that decision. Why are they so bad at that? What in our community needs to die? Unforgiveness. Who do you need to forgive? Who have you held on to that for too long? And here's the thing. Who do you need to forgive, even if you'll always be misunderstood and never get an apology? Because we can't attach, well, if they do this, then I will forgive them. Forgiveness is a one-way street. Reconciliation needs two, but forgiveness only needs one. Who in this community do you need to forgive? What grudge needs to be put to death in the next 13 weeks to get us to Easter Sunday? What destructive attachment do you need to put to death? Where have you said, you know, I'll get by. I'm smart. I can figure this out. I know this isn't great, but, you know, I'm different than most, so I can figure this out on my own. That little destructive thing that nobody knows about, I can manage it. What needs to die? And you know what it is. For some of you, something came to your mind immediately. What needs to die in the next 13 weeks? Platforming. Where are you seeking influence and admiration and recognition and significance beyond just saying, God, to you the glory? And if I have the title or I don't, if I get the recognition or I don't, if I get the applause or I don't, it's not about me. What social media channel needs to die? What platform needs to die? What area of significance needs to die? Friends, what in our community has got to die? The death and resurrection of Jesus is not just some abstract thing that gets us to a good place when we die. It's how the world works. And my prayer for us is that we would actually put some things to death in this community. And you would actually put some things to death in your lives. Me too. I'm preaching to myself here. Things in my life need to die. Because when that happens, Easter morning comes and the resurrection is equally tangible, equally wonderful, equally real. And we could gather on Easter morning and go, oh my gosh, I'm alive. Because Jesus went before me and he did it so that I could do it too. See, the pattern works in a very real way. Death and resurrection. The death and resurrection of Jesus isn't just some nice abstract idea that gets you somewhere when you die. It's how the world works. And if you trust Jesus and his words, when you actually enter into it, you will have life and life to the full. And Jesus institutes a pattern, a rhythm, and he doesn't just talk about it. He embodies it with his death on a cross and a resurrection. That's what the table is for. So we're going to engage in that now. So elders, communion members, if you'd come forward now, it's time to live into this practice. You see, what the table does is it reminds us of Jesus' death. He dies. This is my body. It's broken. This is my blood. It's shed. We remember that he died. But the story of communion doesn't end there, because what Jesus then says is, hey, I'm not going to have this again with you until I have it with you renewed in my Father's kingdom. So this not only represents the death of Jesus, it also is a reminder that one day we're going to feast together in the resurrection. So even built into the elements is this idea of death and resurrection. We die and we're reborn because Jesus did it first. So friends, if you would. Inside here, there is a double cup. So one is the juice. And then if you look up under there, the bread is on there. So you can just grab one and you'll have both elements. We also have some sealed ones if you'd prefer that as well. But we are going to come together as a community to start a journey together. And before you take this, ask yourself, Lord, identify what is it in my life in the next 13 weeks that needs to die? Ask him that. Don't even take the communion. Wait, hold it. Say, God, what is it? What needs to die in me? So that I might experience this resurrection come Easter. Let's take this together.